what it means spiritually, or how?
Well, it's the same as the seasons. There's really essentially four seasons. The first is like gestation and birth, which is like spring, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When the sap start running and then the buds open to that period.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's like the growing to maturity, which is sort of like the summer, and the ripening, autumn, and then the dissolution, death, winter, old age and death. And traditionally, in most societies, you find that the last parts of the life are the parts for, it, like in Native tradition, elders. In Eastern traditions, where you now have the time to turn your mind to spirituality, because you know that the results of all your desires have been, you know what you didn't get, you know, and you know why you've watched enough people get what you didn't get and they're not working, that you know that's neither a hardship nor a, you know, nor a blessing. It's just like, that's what you're doing this time around. And so you start saying, okay, what is the real value? Because you've seen so many things come and go. And you don't have a real role in society other than as an elder, which in our society isn't much. I think I'm very fortunate because my society is mostly made of my friends who have similar interests, and there is actually respect for elders. But for many societies, that's not true. When I go to a doctor, because they now know that...
All the way up.
It is. Does it hum when it...
When it's partway down, it does.
Oh, does it? I wondered why it hums sometimes. I don't know. When I go to a doctor, from the time I was around 60, I noticed that about one out of every three doctors... Because, you know, doctors change a lot in small towns. So you often have a new doctor when you least expect it. Because its latest studies have shown, and they teach it in medical school, that when people get older, particularly women, because women are more sensitive to their bodies, and their sensitivity increases as they get older, they don't sleep as well, da-da-da-da-da, and they really are aware of every little ache and pain, but there's a really strong focus on it. And apparently, they're also very lonely. So that they worry because they're alone, and then the worry makes them afraid that something's wrong. So they come to the doctors with way more complaints, and there isn't really anything wrong with them. So when I was just around 60, was just about, I think I was 61, for the first time I had a doctor look at me and basically tell me I was an old, foolish old woman worrying about something that wasn't. And it was probably because I was lonely. And she really did not look at me, she just dismissed me. Because she had more important things to work with. And that was a doctor. But you notice the same thing, you know, with people, shopkeepers. Right? For some reason, people don't think I look like I'm 67. For some reason. I think I do, but they don't. So when I tell people I'm 67, when they say, ask me my age, they're kind of surprised. And then I notice for probably about half of them, there's a real change in their attitude toward me. So that whole quality of like the stages of life doesn't have the same power in our society, because so much of our culture is based on the market. And the market is based on how much everybody's earning. Do you think that's true? Important things are which stocks are up and which are down. That's real news. I mean, it's reported every day, at least once a day, usually more, on all the mass media. It's basically, you know, what is Christmas about? Sales are up. Oh, but here, sales are down. Oh, online sales are higher. But it's not about, you know, how many people have decided to go into retreat over Christmas because it's a good time to go within, is it? Or an elders conference being held here. It isn't. So we have a kind of a warped, you know, a tilted view of how seasons of life should go because our consumers are our culture. I know that's a little bit rash, but it's also fairly true. If you watch kids in high school, they're taught a lot of really interesting things, really wonderful things. But there is also this kind of feeling of having to be part of a culture.
But then there's a possibility then that if the consumers are the culture, it's going to change. Right, it should be changing right now because the biggest consumers coming up are baby boomers. So it's going to go to
speed. And it is changing. You see more and more commercials with older people.
Mm-hmm.
But you don't see them a commercial for a retreat.
Right.
You see them for get a second mortgage on your home, and you'll never have to move out of it all of the time you're alive. You can take that money and go here and go there and play golf and go on a cruise, you know? It's still like, it seems to me that there isn't the sense in our that is pushed in our culture about elders has more to do with fulfill all your desires. Now you've retired, spend your money on this.
Okay.
Not on, isn't this a good time to contemplate the spiritual nature? Because the desires have died down. You know how fulfilling it is to be a housewife? Or a house husband. You know how fulfilling it is to do this. You know, you've learned all of the non-romantic things that are true. However much you think you won't be lonely if you have this or that or the other, you know it isn't true. So what is it that the heart might really be longing for? That's not advertised for our baby boomers. And you notice that yourself, you know, now that you're into a different age of your life, there's a lot of things that you couldn't let go of because you felt you needed to get them or have them, right?
Mm-hmm.
And suddenly it's like you don't need to perform so much. So the focus in the last phase of life goes out of outer performance and more into who is performing. And what is the most important relationship to that one, for that one? And it's not an outer make, build, get relationship. That's interesting, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
For people who actually conditioning or trauma or whatever reason don't have the opportunity, like me, to join the usual drive of the normal, I think we have an edge on it. We have a better chance of having a good time as we age. And because there is already all those questions of the wisdom of elders and are already a large part of our lives. And there is a real sense of how to focus, of like, what happens when I focus on who I'm not? Like, you know, I know I've repeated it before, but you notice how old people always repeat the same stories. You know, I used to be hitchhiking and I would be with my thumb out on the highway and it would be winter and it would be snowing and I'd be somewhere in the mountains and I would just be weeping and absolutely distraught and in such despair that I couldn't just go to some city and be a secretary. And that was like painful. And I was like, why can't I just fit in? And I ripped myself in shreds with that. I look back now and I think I was so lucky not to fit in. But I didn't think so then. And I didn't think so for a good 20 years, 25 years. There was always a part of me that kept trying, so I tried everything, you know. But it didn't particularly work, But each one of those seasons are a change. They're a change in your hormones, they're a change in your perspective, and they're a change in your deepening of wisdom. The wisdom will deepen regardless of whether you're, quote, successful, end quote, or unsuccessful in coming into the womb and being born well and maturing, for the first 8 years, or going from 8 years to 20 years where you're ripening into full bloom, or going into, the harvesting, the reaping of that bloom into a new career, a new children, whatever. That last part, that wisdom, is as is dissolution and death. All of us have that. It's always there. No matter what your life, whether you think it was successful or not, you're judging it by the criteria of those other stages. When you get to each stage, the criteria for the other stages does not count. When you're a teenager and thinking of, falling in love and then falling out of love and hating your lovers and loving your haters and, all that confusing stuff you do, right? And then when you're like actually have a child, it's like a totally different person. Or don't have a child, but it's still a totally different person. It's like a totally different person. It's not the same person. And when you try to hold the same ideals, you get caught by a surprise divorce or, surprise love affair or whatever. So those are basically the classical four seasons. And they actually correspond to changes in our own thought structure, in our own physical bodies, in our own energies, how the energy is either moving out to manifest one of those first three seasons, or beginning to come back in, which usually happens when, around 60. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm.
Thanks for your question. I think in some ways that's why, your elders are your storytellers and a lot of the more basic communities. Our community has got too many thermostats to be called basic, really. Where you actually are in touch with the seasons and you actually have to pay attention to it and you have to hunt or do stuff like that. Then the elders who are contemplating the past are also usually the babysitters. And it's very natural for them to start telling stories about when they're young, and it's how the wisdom gets passed on. And there are many levels of wisdom. All of us who live have a wisdom. There isn't any, special breed of particular wisdom. Every day teaches us something. We're not too lazy to look for it.
So what happens when, adults really disrespect their older parents? Like, it must have, does it have a profound effect on the older person, say, in where they're going, or it doesn't matter so much?
I don't know, really. I don't really know. I don't know.
It would depend so much on the person, on both people, why someone was disrespecting. You know, I've met people who totally disrespected one of their parents and had really clear description of why they disrespected them. But my experience of them emotionally was they were afraid of the other parent who didn't respect a parent. So it was easier for them to survive. By finding even more things to please than one parent.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there probably is just as many possible scenarios of that as you could imagine. I have no idea.
Mm-hmm.
Case by case, I might know or I might not, but it can be so complex. I mean, I'm just giving you an idea mm-hmm. of the kinds of things I've seen. And you know, sometimes jealousy is a very confusing emotion for Westerners. I don't think they understand it one iota. Jealousy is when you really want something and then you think that somebody else has got it, so you hate them. Did you know that was jealousy?
Mm-hmm.
Most people don't have a clue that that's really what jealousy is, but if you really want something, but you see somebody else get it, and you immediately hate them. And you don't particularly want what they've got. You want them to suffer for getting it. And it's real twisted. And in Buddhism, they say jealousy is a mixture of desire and hatred, and that's exactly my experience. And jealousy very often comes from siblings, not from parents. And when you're jealous of somebody else who has someone who is, you know, seems to have what you want, and if that other one that you want is a person, you'll punish both of them, however you can. You'll like be right and they'll be wrong somehow. You'll manipulate it around to there, because jealousy is so manipulative. So who knows why somebody, maybe because they love them, they're disrespectful. Hard to say. Maybe because they fear them. Maybe because the person's an out-and-out bastard. I don't know. Maybe both sides, the parents are out-and-out, or the kid is. Like, as many motives as there are people, I'll bet. Until you can turn around and look at your own emotions and see your motives for having them. You know, if you're doing self-hatred, what's your motive for that? If you're doing self-love, what's your motive for that? Not that you have to change it, but you have to know what your motive is. What is it you really want here? A lot of times I see people who are jealous, and they don't want that anyway. They just don't want somebody else to get what they think they could have got. I remember two different occasions where I really experienced jealousy strongly. Most of the time I have had very little experience of jealousy in my life. I'm more for greed. Just out and out greed. I just go for pure and full of greed. Forget the hatred. It takes too much focus. Like, it stops me from eating as much. You know, I sort of fluctuate between greed and dullness. But the times that I experienced that jealousy, the most prolonged time was with my beloved teacher. You know, where he was like so extremely kind to me for so
so long. He would send a car to find me wherever I was staying, or if I actually had a room to my room. The car would take me to his place, and he'd have rose petal soup that he just made to share with me. You know, we'd drink some wine. Oh, no, he wasn't drinking wine in those days. It was an attaboy. Or he'd have made some exquisite meal, or he had a book of poetry he wanted to show me. You know, I'm like, you know, I've been living on the streets. I'm not used to this now. This is not the Cecily Quiet that left Mrs. Quiet's home. This is a different Cecily Quiet altogether. And he's going, here, come in, we'll want a guest. Yeah. And the people who were my peers, and, you know, at first it was, oh, it's nice, isn't he being nice to that totally dumb, idiotic little street twerp, you know, he's so compassionate. And then the third or fourth week, what's he seeing her? And the fifth or sixth week, oh yeah, sure. I wonder how she finagled her way into getting to him for dinner again. Seventh or eighth week, right? And after a long period of time, because I was like a wild animal, anything that scared me, I would have gone running. So he fed me. Which is how you tame a wild animal. And when I was tamed and I just wanted to be around him, he said, well, now you can learn how to get along with the rest of the people. Kick me out. So I go back to those who have been figuring out exactly why I'm tricking him into it, right? And they have had like 3-4 months of building it up to a real case. And I've been like such a greed type, totally, I hadn't even noticed that. I wander over to somebody's place, I say, I wonder if it's too late for me to go shopping, and I'm hungry. Do you mind if I come in for dinner? Oh, why don't you go to Rinpoche's? Why don't you go to the Bhikkhu's? So that was, I learned a lot from that. I learned to quit being so sensitive to whether somebody liked me or disliked me, which is what I needed to learn, rather than piling it on myself for more guilt. But then, and then our relationship continued in a much better way, not me the wild animal, but as two people. And I was often invited for dinner or not. But then he started, you know, asking other people to do things that I did really, really well. And looking at me for a minute and going, oh no, you. You know, somebody that wasn't as good at it as me. Like, excuse me. That he had always admired and we'd had wonderful conversations about. And then, like, just walked right by me as if I... And then he started treating me like I was invisible. And he started inviting people to go on trips with him and just saying, you can stay here. And go, well, Cecily will look after your house while you're gone. I really understood jealousy at that point. Bitch, I hope he dies getting on fucking ship. I was so kind and gentle. And it was so bad that it shocked me. So I started turning around and looking at me and saying, why am I doing this? Don't I want her to have a good relationship? I do. Why am I doing this? Because I feel that she has control over something that I think should be mine? Well, that's bullshit. If I want it, I have to find it here. Then later I learned, you know how you can overcome jealousy by gratitude? You have to find it here. Later, I found that out. But in our own hearts, we know the way through all our crap. We all do.
That's why if I repeat something often enough that I've learned the stupid way, that I've actually learned, everybody who needs to learn it gets it from me. You can't learn what you don't already know. But maybe you don't want to believe it. That's possible. I certainly have done that once or twice. And probably continue to. But there is some part of us that hears something that's true. That is so trustworthy. You know, that is so trustworthy. That's what it is that guides, like which season you do what and when. Not what your brain says you should do. Because that's all trying to be safe or trying to get it right. It's not possible to be safe and there is no right. Next. Right is relative. What's right for a bird in the winter is not right for a human. True? Have you eaten suet lately? No? Imagine my surprise. So there's all these twists and turns that by the time you're like in your 60s, late 60s, they start making sense to you in a whole different way. Or you can be caught by your idea of who you should be and become a lonely old woman who runs to a doctor for attention. Flip a coin. Because like T.S. Eliot, you know, it's happening to all of us. I grow old. I grow old.
I shall wear my trouser bottoms rolled.
Shall I? Where is it? Something, something. And walk upon the beach. I have heard the mermaids crying, each to each. You know, I grow old. I grow old. Shall I wear my trouser bottoms? Shall I part my hair behind? Do I dare to eat a peach? I can't remember it now. But that whole kind of quality, all, you know, is always going to be in your last season of life or when you're on retreat, self-reflection. But it can be self-reflection based on your image of who you think you should be or your trust of, that you are what you should be. Which way do we want to reflect? So if you use all the seasons according to the opportunities and the desires to the best of your ability, your reflection isn't going to be a problem at all. It's whether you're willing to recognize it, your life as the gift it is rather than the gift you thought it should be that makes the difference. And that's true, isn't it? I mean, would you have chosen half the experiences you've had to go through with your little ankle biters in a perfect world? But by God, hasn't it taught you and opened your heart and told you how to use an open heart? Would anything else have done it as well?
It has taught me. Yeah, I'm not sure I learned everything, but it has taught me.
It has taught you. I think you've learned a lot. I think we all do. And a lot of the learning we sure as heaven are not happy about when it's happening. And maybe there are things that, you know, in the last part of our lives we say, I really didn't understand what was happening there. But we should never say, I wish I had never done that. We should say, I have now learned that I didn't understand what was happening there. Not, I shouldn't have done that. You cannot afford to negate your own existence. It is a gift. It is a gift if only for the fact that you can think and talk. And so use it like it's a precious gift. Use it to make your thoughts the best offering, your speech the kindest. And that means inside as well as outside. That's the number one rule of spirituality. Not being right, not being successful, not getting what you want. Those are not. Those are like, maybe, maybe not. The kindness, number one. You can't get the other three with any kind of satisfaction without number one. That's the bottom line. Well, you already knew that, didn't you? Can you help me? You knew that. The value we have for each other is every once in a while one of us forgets, and so we remind each other. That's a community, you see. Sometimes we remind each other without even moving our lips. You just see one of our community perform an act of kindness and something opens in you. It's neat. Any other? You can tell I'm getting older because I tell so many personal stories, many more than I even used to. March them out, the drop of a hat.
The age of storytelling.
Pardon?
Passing the wisdom.
Yeah. I keep wanting to phone Wayne, talk to him, because I want to talk to him about the practice, because I figured, and I hope I'm wrong, but I figured when I sent it to him, he would look at it and try it a few times, but he would lose interest. Because I figured he wouldn't see where the focus was, because it took me about 15 years to see how to focus on that practice. And I do see real similarities between he and I. And so I keep meaning to phone him, so I was hoping to see him tonight. So tell him that I'd like to talk to him. Because I know that it took me, you know, I did that meditation for a long time, but it was like, oh, nothing else, or what does that have to do with me? Well, when I actually, I don't know why I got it, I think because I was doing another type of meditation that's a similar movement of energy, and I went, wait, that's, and then I understood how that focus goes in that way. So if you wouldn't mind telling me that. I felt badly that I emailed it to you somehow, but I must have had an old email address, or...
Oh, we did have some problems with our Outlook also for a while, so maybe...
So probably just when I mailed it.
Probably.
Because I was a week late, and I realized, you know, I kept meaning to get it off to him, and I realized, you know, I better just email. I had yours. And then I wanted to talk to him within a week of him doing it, but then, da-da-da-da-da, you know. What with you guys refusing to live in Didsbury, I don't know.
Just build a bigger theater than our act.
We don't like the dogs, though.
Did you hear the latest on that?
No.
The kids were joyriding in the car and they weren't supposed to take the car. They're 17. And they were really sneaking and running home. And their family dog was following them. And they didn't see the dog and they backed up in the air. And they thought, oh my God, what are we going to do? Because the car wasn't supposed to be moved. And they panicked. She's almost dead. Well, if we just drag her, she'll die right away because she's suffering if we can't bring her in. You know? They freaked. With bad judgment, like adolescents do. They started dragging her. And the one kid said, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't go. And he started leaving. He left. The other one said, I can't do it either. I can't leave the dog like that. We can't call the vet. So he took a shovel and hit her. And he thought she died, and he put her in the back seat of the car. But he was so freaked out, he didn't close the door properly. Dog fell out when he turned the corner. He still got it tied to the back. They're freaked out. They're driving along the road, and he falls out. He goes, oh. No, he's by himself, because the other kid went home and was, like, shaking. Freaked out too. You know. Everybody's freaked out. You know how bright teenage boys are anyway. All those hormones racing through their being. And how, what that would do, they were doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. And this incredible disaster happened. They went right over the top. And so dog falls out, and just as he's going back and like, well, should I hit her? And he sees she's still alive. Should I hit her again? Oh my God, I don't know what to do. Oh, and then she sort of stopped gasping and stopped breathing for a while. Oh, she died. So undid the chain and was about to drive away, and the person pulled around the corner and stopped. So I just saw him putting the bloody shovel back in the car. The back of the car was bloody. Dog, they'd done the masking tape because the dog was yowling so much. And, you know? The masking tape was in the car. But why the people came to the courthouse and why it caught such a media attention, why the media decided to focus on it, and before it was an actual trial, and why the people who came to the trial to protest animal rights were actually quite violent and vicious outside the courtroom. They would have beat the hell out of those kids and probably killed them if they hadn't been stopped. I don't know the story behind that. But that's the story in Didsbury amongst the friends of the family. That's a different story, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. I was talking to you a couple days ago about activism and how I've been quite put off by it.
By the violence in it.
And I think, I mean, this has been going on for a few years. I remember 3 or 4 years ago at the university, they had a video about, the World Trade Organization and the protests and stuff like that. And they had a video of all these people, you know, their people they were with, taunting these police officers.
Yeah.
And you could see the fear in their eyes because they didn't know what they were supposed to do. And I don't think this seems to be lost in the people there, but I just...
Yeah.
Like, you know, these are people too, and how are you acting towards them?
Exactly.
And I saw a little more of that on the internet, and how you can't, you know, I tried carrying on a dialogue, and I mean, maybe there are some things I say that are, you know, that I don't see, but
you try people, to be very respectful.
Yeah, I try, and it just, like,
yeah, and
it's
some people
impossible.
Yeah, because some people want to be in a war.
Yeah, and maybe it's also hard trying to open someone else's eyes. Like, maybe that's part of the process. Like, maybe that's what I can't.
You can open somebody else's eyes, but you can present the other side.
Yeah.
You're going to get shot at.
Yeah.
But you also want to think, well, it's good for somebody to bring up this, the other side. I have a friend, I haven't talked to her for years. She's actually the daughter of someone who was quite a close friend of mine who died of cancer in Australia. And she's, I met this person when she was living in Canada, and her daughter trains people on how to be peace activists. And she's really excellent at it. She just blows me away, her clarity about it. And I have done a lot of peace activism in my time. So we have nice dialogue about a lot of things. And one time I was talking to her, and she was talking about how she couldn't travel out of the country because she was... she had been held in contempt of court for refusing to answer some questions for some inquiry or something. Or I don't know what it was, exactly what it was, but she was on trial, and until she had done her trial, she wasn't allowed to leave the country.
Sort of like civil disobedience.
Yeah, kind of thing. And I said, well, what were you planning to do? And she said, well, there was going to be a big... a demonstration against global economy, and there was going to be a big training session for how to be a peaceful protester. And she's really known for training people how to do that, peaceful protester. And she started, so we were talking about that, and we were talking about how it happens, and I said, but it must be really hard to be a peaceful, because a lot of, you know, a lot of the protests I've been at, it has really scared me how unpeaceful the protesters are. Don't you ever get angry when you see something that is where you're actually being blocked from being heard? And she seems like, you know, she was like 22 when I was having this conversation with her. This is a few years ago. She looks at me and she smiles and she said, you know, Cecily, the day I find myself angry is the day I'll quit. I thought, okay, that's worth it, isn't it? That's like, yeah, that's right. So if somebody else gets angry, they get angry. That's their problem. Maybe send them to work with Andrea for 6 months. That would be good training. Our sweet Andrea, who's such a good teacher. Because you have to keep remembering she's a human being. You'd like her to be inconvenient, but you have to keep remembering she's a human being. And her power against us is that we wish her to be better. Isn't it? When we get agitated with her, it's because we wish she would change. Not because we are happy that we have the right to speak to her about our care for her.
We want to change her mind.
We want her to change so she isn't an inconvenience. So, I mean, talk about a good teacher. I mean, we couldn't have got a better teacher. And she remains a good teacher. Look how sneaky I have to get over, be in order not to lie to her. And she accuses me, you know, if she answers the phone. I'm not lying about not hearing the message. I have to be very clear. I didn't listen to her message.
And I'm not sure exactly what she said.
Yeah. Well, it's true. You told me three different things. So
I did. I could tell you a fourth.
No. Please don't. And isn't that exactly it? There are always going to be people whose neuroses fit a political situation. People who are fighting for the underdog because they feel like they were badly treated, or, you know, people who have to do everything right because they're afraid that maybe they didn't when they were children or something, you know. And so that it becomes a neurosis, so it's like actually irritating to other people. And who knew that?
So
you
can
know,
you
you're just trying to do what's right. Mm-hmm. You know?
Mm-hmm.
But that's the problem. Well, who knew that? I'm just fighting for peaceful coexistence. Yeah, I'm fighting. You know? And sometimes the best way for us to see our neuroses is to see what we're passionate about and then what we're mouthy about. Maybe my neuroses is Dharma. Fits one of those criteria. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, it's okay. I can't remember because I may have changed a little bit along the way. I was wondering at one point if you can be, or if there's many people that can be political and be, not fall into all those traps or be spiritual at the same time.
Yeah, yeah. And how? By being willing to be honest.
Mm-hmm.
That's the only criteria. Like, I mean, again, Adrea is a great teacher. When you actually want to help her, or when you want her to not need you.
Mm-hmm.
Two different things, aren't they? I mean, not interfere with your life, need you.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're so busy or whatever. You know, there's a difference, isn't there? Yeah, so, like, you know, I'm lucky because I don't have a phone message that she can jam up, and besides, I'm the head of the conspiracy, so she doesn't call me.
Mm-hmm.
Except if I call her, and then there's a brief interlude, interaction. You know,
can't
for
jam
a day.
Up your thing?
Hmm?
She can't jam up your message? Your answering machine?
Well, she hasn't. Maybe, you know, I'll use my cell phone. Most people don't even know I have one. Almost nobody has the number.
So when we find out what we're passionate about and what we're mouthy about, what does that tell us?
One of the things, like when you're passionate about something, it should, I'm using passionate as a wholesome,
right.
It should make you feel excitement and openness. Like you feel when you're thinking about, you know, my friend when I'm talking about her in the peace movement. You feel your heart kind of open and you're going, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a passion. That's like, yeah, that feels comfortable, like me. I want to move more in that way. Right?
Mm-hmm.
When you're right about something, it's usually about trying to find who's wrong. Or what you don't want, or, you know, there's usually that kind of little fight in it.
Mm-hmm.
As right as an identity, more than passion is.
Yeah. Passion seems to be about possibilities, but and not just...
That's my experience.
Yeah.
That's my experience, so that's why I'm using those words. I'm glad you understand why I understand it the same way. Passion is like a warming and a growing kind of feeling. And right is like a line. There's the line of the sun. So when we're reading the Majjhima Nikaya, quite often we see the Buddha being quite passionate. We don't very often find him being right. You know, remember that sutra a few back? Where somebody is reported as saying it's okay to have sensual pleasures even if you're a monk, because a monk can do that, and he doesn't get ticked off at that guy. He gets ticked off at him not examining his views. He says, "Why aren't you examining your views? Where did you hear that? I never said that. Why are you saying I teach that? Look at your view. What is that view dependent on? That view is dependent upon an I with a position. All of my teaching points at a no fixed I, no fixed position. You're not representing me when you talk like that. That's not you. Remember that sutra? Beautiful. It was one we did twice. I thought it was so good I did it twice. So that's like a passion for clarity.
And it's inclusive, not exclusive.
Exactly. It's like, look at what that does. That sets you in a separateness. That's the opposite of the teaching. Neat, eh? I swear it is the most important thing to learn, both internally and externally. It's what I call friendliness. None of us are free. None of us are free. None of us are free if one of us is chained. If I'm trying to chain somebody else to my beliefs, I don't believe in freedom. So I'm definitely a Buddhist on this one.
So, you know, how does that work then with, you know, like the other day I was at a restaurant for lunch and they have a TV there. So you don't hear anything, but you see it all. The news.
The news. The violence.
The violence. And they're all...
The wars.
They're in the Middle East. Yeah. And
the
they're
bombs
all...
bombs and the rifles.
Yeah, and they're all running and they're all killing it. They're, and you just...
And you're eating.
Hatred.
And you're eating. I know.
But the hatred was
it gets
so
that primal hunger going. Better eat. We're going to get killed any moment.
Well, they weren't thinking about eating for sure there.
No, I'm talking about the restaurant patrons.
Yeah. What's with these TVs in the corner?
Wait.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah?
So, I'm...
Hold that thought.
I was looking at it and it was so profound for me. The hatred that was on that screen and the hatred they had for each other and that there would never be peace if all that hatred was there. Like it was just phenomenal. The
it's tangible.
Yeah. Whether they were being aggressive or not, the aggression, the hatred aggression was so...
Yeah, and that people are trained to do that and then brought back to be peaceful.
How do you mean?
Well, you've heard me say before, you know, where the Hells Angels started. Oh.
Mm-hmm.
I've said it more than once in this very room.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, I've all been to all my classes. That's pretty straightforward. Why would you have heard me? Just because I've said it a couple of times. All right, settle that up, okay. Second World War vets when they came back.
So what they started?
That's how where the Hell's Angels started. And some of them got together, and there was no way of integrating, you know, in the native community. If somebody is a warrior after they've been to war, the some of the elders and the shaman, whatever you would call it, the shaman of the tribe, goes out to the woods to meet them and brings them back with ceremony. And there is this march to welcome the warriors back, and there is this whole ritual cleansing and joy. And, you know, a particular way of going to a particular tree and, you know, and there's a whole ritual around it. And it's considered that they are integrated back and they are the people most trained to do the sun dance because it's a warrior's dance. You have to put up with extremes of dementia, nothing to eat or drink for 3 days, drink a little bit after sunset, dancing all day, sleeping with particular positions for different understandings, turning in certain ways, very much a dream hallucination, going in, ending up, with those who want to, because now their skin is softened with oil, because now they've lost a lot of weight, so they have flaps of skin, taking a hook and barbing themselves with it and dancing back and forth to the pole, which represents the center, and their pain of going back and forth to the center of the tribe, of the family, and then finally breaking the pole and ending up breaking the thing through their skin and coming. I mean, it's profound. For some men, it's profound. And you'd be surprised how many Vietnam veterans have joined Sundances. You'd be surprised. It's like, it's incredible. Especially if you go down to some of the smaller, real Sundances that are that holy. But those who didn't have that kind of thing, they came back, okay, well, welcome home, here's your parade, okay, now settle down, get a job, get married, raise a family. Some of them just became street people. Some of them took a look around, tried to fit in, couldn't do it. Buried their sense of value, tattooed FTW, fuck the world, on their knuckles, and joined a gang. Made a gang. That's where the Hells Angels come from. It's not a surprise, is it? Really? When you look at it. I've never actually asked for the Hells Angels, because when I knew some of the Hells Angels in San Francisco, I was too interested in riding on the backs of their bikes stoned to pay attention to that. I learned about that much later. But, you know, that's how it starts. It's basically, the world has fucked me, fuck the world. So there's this kind of thing of like, not understanding the role of a warrior. And again, our focus is so much on, you know, cooperating to keep the market flowing. You know, what should we be teaching at schools to keep the market flowing, to keep America the richest country, you know, North America. That we lose something there, don't we? What in particular were you asking about then?
I don't know exactly what I was asking, but it just had such a profound effect when I saw the hatred on the screen and thought, how can people expect ever to have peace when there's all this hatred? Maybe they can stop the war, but it's just going to emerge again.
Which is what I'm saying, isn't it?
Yeah.
It does emerge. It does. And that's what the Buddha said, hatred does not hit. It does not end by hating. Hatred does not end by hatred. Yeah, he said a lot of interesting things about hatred. One of the things he said about hatred is interrupted desire creates aggression. That's pretty straightforward, isn't it? You want something, you don't get it, don't you get angry? Is that useful? It's useful for a short period of time until you notice that you're gnawing your own flesh with your anger. Just at the time when you need a little flesh for a Sundance, you don't have any. Come back to the center, you don't have any. You use it all up with anger. You didn't know that you were actually tattooing FTW on your knuckles with your anger. You didn't notice that. And that was at least a relief from feeling like you didn't have what you wanted. But what kind of relief? A relief that brought you something you didn't want? Or a relief that said, well, you know, there, I got out of that. Why not say, if you want to get away from something you don't want, why not find out you do have that you do want? Oh yeah, it doesn't have quite the drama appeal. Oh, that's true. And we love those rushes. But in the long term, it's better. And it's sure as heaven on earth is kinder. Yeah, and you know, hatred sells bombs. Or new doors, or new computers, or new cars, or...
Fear is good for business.
Fear and hatred are very good for business. So, like, what's your value here? You know, that's what it comes down to, is your value making a profit, getting something, getting what you desire, and so therefore you use anger? Or is it kindness? Notice I keep talking about the same thing today. Kindness. Kindness actually calms hatred. Hatred just sets another fire, sort of like as if to counteract it, but then it changes. And it becomes a bigger fire.
So, I mean, going back, when Gandhi was in India and there was all that hatred.
Started in Africa, actually.
Right.
In South Africa.
But the anger in
India
itself. And then when he went there, then with his. Like, did he have so much intention that he kind of motivated and dragged everybody with him?
He knew he didn't like what was happening.
Right.
And he knew he did not want to be angry. And he knew, you know, I don't know if you've heard Bonnie Raitt's latest CD.
Mm-hmm.
It has this song, I May Break, I May Bend, but I Don't Break. And that's what Gandhi knew. You may have to bend. You may have to let go of a little bit of pride. But if you know what you won't do, if you won't be disrespectful to yourself or to others, there's nothing anyone can take from you.
But then he was one person. How was he able to grab that whole country countries?
Because so many people knew that it was disrespectful, but they were afraid to act. But when one person acts, it's like a catalyst. A lot of people, you know, a lot of people who were Germans were helping in the resistance, were helping people, you know, get out of prison camps or get out of Germany. There are a lot of people who were afraid, and some of those people were able to act. When they're here, right under the, you know, you saw Schindler's List, but there were a lot of others too. A lot of others whose names will never be heard. For one name you hear, there's 1,000 people that make just one move that make it all happen. It's a choice, and it's a personal choice, which can move the world. Because every time your thoughts don't go to anger, but go to kindness, that changes a molecule of thought in the world. You know you can feel other people. Guess what? Other people can feel you. Guess what? We could feel our way through this. I noticed it's not a majority Republican Senate.
And what?
Is that shocking or what? That's very interesting.
And a woman who says, I mean, I don't know a lot about U.S. politics, but they said, what's the first thing you're going to do? She says, I'm going to clean up the swamp we're living in. Mm. They said, what do you mean? And she said, exactly what I said. And they said, do you mean that you say that there's dishonesty here? And she said, it's a swamp, and I'm cleaning it up.
Yeah, and the media always looking for the adrenaline story.
Mm-hmm. And she started in politics when she was about 55 or something like this.
during the Vietnam War, they started this thing called the Good Earth Catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And it was essentially a peace activist catalog. And it was a catalog full of things you could do yourself, or products from all over the world, and full of, I have a couple of copies of old ones.
We
all used to read it.
At a farm.
Everywhere, no matter, everybody, all over North America. Even people who weren't hippies read it. Slowly, one would land up in their house because their kid would visit or something. And they never quite threw it out, you know? I also have the last Whole Earth Catalog.
The last one?
It's called the last Whole Earth Catalog. And every once in a while I take it out and look at it, and it's like just full of useful ideas and things. You know, it was a huge book put out by a bunch of hippies. And it sold out. Every issue sold out. And they have little things in it saying, feel free to reprint this anytime you want. You know? And good ideas. Because you know what the media was like in Vietnam. I mean, same as the media in Iraq. And maneuvering and politicking and denials. Right? And the gassing. I mean, the gases they used in Vietnam.
Mm.
All forests are still dead.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't being reported honestly. So you have the Good Earth Catalog. That was pretty effective. I'll bet you there's an awful lot of people, if they haven't read it themselves and remember it, heard about it somehow. Yeah, I think I heard something about that from my parents. And it was like a pipe dream. It was definitely a pipe dream.
A lot in the pipe.
Dream. Your usual pipe dream from the 60s. There was a lot of altruism in the 60s. That was what was so interesting about the 60s. The drugs were something, but the pipe dream was something else. The optimism of
mm-hmm.
it. Make love, not war.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
The shocking thing is that there was one culture here, and it was almost like a line drew, and everybody else becomes somebody else if you're born after this date.
Yeah, I was one of those people who used to think if you were over 30, you were dead. I think I stopped thinking that when I was 27, actually. Always have been a bit forward-looking. Oh, I'm still alive. Maybe 35. But, you know, in the early 60s, 61, 62, people were kind to each other. 64, 65, when it got more Haight-Ashbury and more drugs, and it started being a little more commercial. But when it started because of it being a good idea. We don't want to be in war. We don't want to be at war. We don't like this war. We don't like just working for a new washing machine. We don't like that. We want to be community. And that was the feeling. It was quite profound.
But what's interesting, though, now is the, let's call it the senior citizens now, were the teenagers then. And they're
well,
the ones.
I was a little older than a teenager. And I'm
well,
a
but
citizen.
I'm not quite a senior citizen either. But you know, I lived through all that, right? So I'm just saying, I'm going to use that word structure, right?
Okay.
Because now, the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, it's, you know, our age group that are still doing the same thing, saying no to it, the same as we did for Vietnam. And now it's the younger group that are saying, no, no, go, go, go.
Really, the younger group?
Quite a few.
I haven't found that.
Oh, I have quite a few. You, when you see them on TV, you know, the younger Americans are saying go. I mean, they even had a peace demonstration in Ottawa and all these people for war came.
Yeah, but the media is reporting it.
Oh, okay.
Don't forget that. Because when I, you know, when I go down to the States, or I see it not more for war.
Oh, okay.
I see more young people involved in born-again churches.
Mm.
Because it's a really nice, exciting, high, rebellious thing to do, because your parents probably aren't.
Yeah.
I don't know, and certainly for a long time, that was encouraging the war. Because there was this kind of, you know, urban myth about as soon as Iraq was made safe for a democracy, then Israel wouldn't be under threat, and Israel has to be free so that Jesus can return, and Jesus is returning any time. I've heard this from ministers.
Really?
Yeah, you know, from people who go to churches like this in the States when I've been down there. Yeah. And there is this kind of little sort of using the born-again movement to fund both Israel's... Yeah, Israel actually... The prime minister, is it a prime minister of Israel? About 4 years ago, the prime minister of Israel was invited to the States. I'm not sure, but I think it was... 9 times in a 2-year period, or 7 times, and only 2 of those visits were to government heads. The others were born again Christians revival meetings where they had raised money to give to Israel so Israel could fund its weaponry to maintain its freedom.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow.
So I'm not sure how much of that was a con game by politicians to keep the Republican Party, but there were a few Republicans who were not that Christian, but who held a Christian face, because they believed that the Republican Party was the right party for whatever reason. Mm-hmm. So like, there's layers and layers of it, and like, you know, there's lots of ways to get teenagers excited about being rebels. Especially because teenagers really prefer rules, but they're terrified of obeying their parents. You know? Isn't that true?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to show that you're one of the social group and daring, but it would be really nice if you had a reason not to. Oh, I don't want to stay out all night. But I can't, you know? My mom, or dad, you know? And there's that kind of edge between being daring and hoping you don't have to be. It's like walking on a cliff. It's tough. Tough being a teenager. So that, you know, if you have a way to go to a church and make these outrageous vows about being a virgin until you marry, and, you know, but you've got some principle to honor, and the rules are laid out. Damn, that's perfect. So there's lots of young people that do that. I don't know how long they last at. Maybe a long time. And there are people who started believing these stories 15, 20 years ago, and they have babies who have been raised in those churches. So there's
so where do they get that Jesus is coming back to Israel?
Jesus has to be reborn in Israel, and these are the last days. There are thousands of interpretations of the Bible that can tell you about this kind of prophetic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's quite a strong belief system amongst a percentage of the population. And I think that has more effect on it because they can organize the turnouts of young people, because it's their duty before God, they're God's army. It's kind of scary, you know.
They do that here too.
Oh yeah, all over North America, all over the West.
There's a conference at the Rex Hall for 5 days, I think it is, and it's all day into the night. Completely fills Rex Hall, and they start, because I did it 1 year, and it starts at like 8 in the morning for, it goes 8 till noon, and then in the afternoon, and then it's like doing 3 rock shows in 1 day, every day for 3 days.
And there's lighting, and there's music, and
very
drama, and
it's huge. It's just huge. And they're all bouncing, they have this kind of thing, they bounce. And the whole building is shaking. Like that.
Really?
Yeah.
Because I'm up on the catwalk, and it kind of...
Now, when you said you were doing it...
It was like a fall spot.
What?
A fall spot.
What's that?
A big spotlight.
Oh, okay.
For the rock show part of it, because there's always a band.
A rock show, some of the best rock music now is...
There's a speaker.
Born Again Christian.
Yeah. Yeah, they've got a huge organization, a large, and
they put a lot of money into it, and
it's very pushed. It was very well organized too. And they had all the we call it GAC, but you know, t-shirts and whatnot, merchandise, and it's very elaborately merchandised. And the amount of money that, like, we estimated everybody would spend at least $100 on merchandise. And meals and all this is happening.
Well attended.
Oh yeah, and the spin-offs of it, the spin-offs of buses. There's all the stuff you don't understand, but if you were going to organize an event, you're taking a piece of every little bit of action, about 15 to 35%, depending.
Mm-hmm.
If you're busing in from all over the province, 2,000 youth,
that's
3 days. You got accommodation, busing, food, merchandise, plus the fee to get in. You start adding it up, and there is a ton.
Huge.
And they bring in people from all over the country, really good musicians, really good bands, really good speakers. And it runs like clockwork.
Yep.
And they do this, it's an industry, because these kind of events happen all over the place.
Yep.
And there's, you know,
and
in a way...
And the speakers are idols who go around to different...
What
places.
I tried to do is do loving kindness practice while it was happening, because there's all this...
Hysteria.
Well, yeah, but it was like they wanted to practice loving kindness, but they didn't have a clue what they were doing. It's kind of how I interpreted it.
Mm.
So I went, you know, I was trying to say, well, may all this energy be loving kindness. You know, I'm trying at least, because I had to be there.
Yeah, good
right?
for you.
And they weren't malicious. This wasn't a malicious.
No,
they weren't
it isn't.
Right wing. They were too young for all of that. They really was loving kindness.
Channeling their energy.
So it's kind of like the Beatles admiration.
Yeah, exactly, or anything,
you know,
but channeled with this story.
Right.
Yeah, and they just kept doing it, and they were fine. It was very, I didn't find anything really wrong with it, and I've done a lot of that stuff over my lifetime, and some of it can get very evil, and this wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the fellow that was running it is a local guy, and I watched him the whole time, and I didn't find any cracks in his armor that led me to believe that he was crooked. You know.
Yeah, no,
but
I know there's some very good.
The next place he was going was the Ukraine. He wanted to take it to the Eastern Bloc. There are some very earnest
people in it, but like there is also a lot of messages going around about it too.
But there's a hairline between that and brown shirts.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That enthusiasm.
Yeah. And if you channel it to fear instead of loving kindness, that's what you're going to get. And I notice people...
Well, when your bliss wears off, you know, interrupted desire creates aggression.
Well, when
it can be a holy war like that.
That time that I actually read the New Testament, and I had 6 going at the same time. 6 versions.
Yeah.
And I was so shocked at the modern ones, how
the words changed.
Totally. Like, even the...
And the old ones?
Yeah. It was shocking to see. And
did you have a Torah, too?
No, I didn't.
Yeah. That's not the New Testament, anyway. It's the old.
Right. And I've been meaning to go do the Old Testament, yeah. And I should do that, but I...
Have you read Spohn? Bishop Spohn?
No.
He's good, isn't he? Have you read Spohn? S-P-O-N-G. He has written some really interesting books on the Bible. He's a scholar, and he's compared lots of things, including books that most of us can't get. Lots of translations.
Because what I was wondering was how they...
I remember the names of a couple of his books. There's a newer one out within the last year or two. He's really interesting.
One of the ones I was wondering how you get a copy of was that one that the Vatican didn't release, that G-N-O...
Not the Gnostic Gospel,
yeah.
Or sometimes called the Gospel of Thomas. It's beautiful.
Oh, I have a CD about that.
Gnostic Gospels you can get. You should be able to get it on Amazon.
Really?
I think so.
Yeah, I'll give you the one.
Good.
Have an opportunity or lend it to you.
There you go.
What was
he's going to lend you one.
The what of Luke?
Huh?
Something of Luke, you said?
No, of Thomas. What is it? What did I say?
The Gospel of Thomas.
Gospel of Thomas, isn't it? Is it called the Lost Gospel? Or
the Lost Gospel.
Something like that. I can't remember whether it is lost.
I think that's what.
Something like that.
Okay.
That's been around for a long time, and that is really beautiful.
There's
some old songs, like the Irish song, Dance, Dance, Wherever You May Be, I Am the Lord of the Dance City. It comes basically from the Thomas teaching. It's beautiful. Yeah. It's just beautiful. I love that one. And I also love the Gnostic Gospels. And is it Elaine's, what's her name, the woman? Anyway, you'll find that one without a problem. You should be able to find both of them.
She might be the one on the CD, but it's a lecture of hers.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah. There's no problem.
Just email me or something.
Okay. Yeah, I'd like that, because I...
You know what? It's 10 after 9.
I thought it was really interesting, the things that I was reading about it. So.
Yeah, it is. It is.
I thought
it
would be another version of my other six.
No, neither of those books will be another version of your other six. The Spohn will have you revisiting your other six. Have you read Bishop Spohn? He's no longer a bishop, I don't think.
Well, when...
I can't remember the title. He's got three books out, I think, but...
About
three that I have, but...
5 or 10 years ago at the museum, they had a Christianity... show there.
You know what? I know how you and I love to talk.
Okay.
And it's 10 after 9, and I'm tired. So hold that thought.
Oh, I don't want to.
I know. Interrupted desire.
Okay.
So you notice this beautiful gold light in your hearts? Wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together. We share it with all beings. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. Whatever wholesomeness has been gathered by our coming together, we share it with all beings, so there is less suffering. So thank you for your great compassion.